Okay, so the issue I want to deal with is transparency and accountability in halachic thought. Really a snapshot of it. But I think it's an important topic to talk about. I've written about it. I've written about it quite a bit, actually. At least two installments of my series that I wrote for the VBM 2 years ago was from it, which is where I had this translation of the Chasam Sofer from that I, you know, was nice enough to give you rather than the original. So I want to analyze both the sugya says, but I also want to, again, speak about this on the meta level a bit, because it really is surprising, the Gemara's approach to transparency and accountability. Okay, so the Gemara on Daf Chet Amud Bet tells you that what is one of the main goals, right? This is our Gemara, right? One of the main responsibilities of the Tzedaka collectors is to be above reproach, right? To be above reproach, right? To make sure that no one can suspect them of doing anything wrong. So, what things does the Gemara outline are their responsibilities? The Gemara has several. What? Wait, let's start with our Gemara. Our Gemara, Baba Basra. That's how we got into it. So the first thing, what is the first thing the Gemara says?
It has to be at least two people.
Very good. The first thing was what we started the sugya with, which is that kupa shel tzaka nigbeit bishnayim u'mitchaleket bishlosha. It's collected by two and divided by three. Meaning you don't do this alone. Very good. So we saw that it's a machloket. Who thought that it was about trust? Right, so we saw that it was a question. Right, we saw machlokes, the extent to which this is only about trust, or it's about court. We saw Rashi versus Rav Elchanan Wasserman. Yes. But that's the first thing that the Gemara introduces on this account. But then later on, and this is the main point, later on in the Gemara, on the bottom third of the wide lines in Chet Amud Bet, towards the end of the whole page, Tana Rabbanan, Gabaei Tzedaka Inan Reshain Lifrosh Ze Mizeh, Aval Poresh Ze Lishar Vize Lichanut, that the two money collectors aren't even allowed to separate from each other while collecting the money. Right? The farthest they can go is, this one is going to the gate, this one to the chanut, but they have to be within, right? They have to be able to see each other, right? They don't have to walk like hand in hand the whole time, right? But, right, it's sort of a, you know, funny picture. They hold each other with one hand and collect with the other hand, right? You don't have to do that. But you have to be within eyesight. And Rashi says, what's the reason? What does Rashi say?
Yeah, he said mishum
chshad, right? Because we're worried. Shelo yomru zegov yichid dato lignov. We don't want people to look at them and say that they're stealing. So therefore, we make sure that two people are always doing it, and therefore, there's always accountability to each other. Matzama ot bashuk. If he finds money on the street, which he's allowed to keep, right? He's a money collector, and while he's going, he finds a $100 bill. Right? Okay, good. Lucky him. So, what's the halacha? Lo yitnein b'toch kiso. What does he have to do?
He can't look sus, so he has to put it in the
truck. Right. He's not allowed to put it in his pocket, because someone will definitely say, he just pocketed, literally, the money that he collected for tzedakah. So he just puts it in the tzedakah and at home and no one can see. Right? Then he knows that that was really his money and he takes it. I know that might sound sketchier if someone happens to look into the window at exactly that moment where he's taking money from the tzedakah and putting it in his wallet, but on balance, it's better for him to wait till he's in private to take that money rather than to, while collecting stock of money, be pocketing some of it. Right? That looks much worse. What, Rami?
I feel like this raises a question. Like, if you're going to be a thief and as a charity collector,
it's a great way. It's how many people? That's like, people love doing that. It's money laundering heaven.
But I'm just curious. Like, does it make it better by specifically doing it in private so no one suspects you?
If you're actually stealing, nothing will make it better.
No, but look, why don't you feel like putting emphasis on my that there's a value of not being suspected by society?
Well, one sec. Yeah, obviously, because they don't want to think you're doing something wrong. Obviously, you shouldn't be doing something wrong. That's worse. Right? That's worse. Okay, one second. Hold the thoughts. Hold it, Rami. So the Gemara says, similarly, Yitlein, the same as if you're collecting money that's owed to you. Then the Gemara says more. Gabay tamchoy shein lemanim lechalek mochren lachirim ve mochren latzmam. If you have excess food, you have nothing to do with it, so you want to sell it to hold on to the money for later, you can't sell it to yourself because we're worried that you're going to give yourself a good deal, right? An unfair deal. And we don't want people to suspect that you're taking advantage of the charity. But you can sell it to other people and put the money in the bank account of the charity, but you can't sell it to yourself. If you're counting the money, you're not allowed to count by twos. You have to count one at a time. Why? You're afraid that someone's going to what? Robin, you got to be louder.
You're afraid that creative accounting.
No, that people will think that he's doing, right? I mean, creative just like this, right? Meaning, yes, 100 shekel, right? Right, this, right? Right? You don't want him to be able to do that, so you have to go bill by bill, or coin by coin, right? It's much easier to miscount when you're, right? It's like, yeah, this is about $5. Yeah, you know? I don't know, but it's a lot of American cash, actually, that I look at it. It's actually a lot of it. And this is when you suspect, it's like, who are you robbing? I don't even know why I have this in my wallet, honestly. Right? What? I don't know. I really should put it. Leave it at home. I don't know. I really don't use cash at all. Like, I just... I have so much... You don't understand how many currencies I have in my wallet. I have American, I have Canadian, I have Euro, I have, like... I have some Israeli, you know... I don't know. Swiss francs, I think.
From back when you used to go recruiting every year,
you used to spend... No, that's why I have it. Meaning, I always had... Like, at home, I have American money because I always have some American money from, you know, I lived in America, you know, I have money, whatever. When I go to America, if I take out of my account to spend, to whatever, right? Canadian, I have a Canadian account because I lived there for 3 years, right? But like when I go recruiting in England, you always want a little bit of money in case you have to pay for a cab and for some reason your credit card isn't working because it's a foreign country and sometimes they mess up and whatever, right? Sometimes you're in a foreign country, use your credit card and like... You know, the credit card company forgot to make a note that you were traveling, so they'll freeze it, so I always have some, you know, so I had some pounds. Then we were in Switzerland last year, so I had some Swiss francs, right? And then, like, I flew through Poland back to Canada, so Ora bought a coffee, so I had Euro, right? I mean, like, I'm saying, between, like, all the currencies I have and, like, the 1.5 million passports I have because of the multiple citizenships that everybody in my family has. 2 or 3 citizenships per person. I feel like a drug smuggler. It's like, you know, it's like, yes, here we are, you know, we used to be 5 people traveling on 13 passports, right? Now we'll be 7 people traveling on, you know, 19 passports, right? I mean, it's like, you know, it's very sketchy looking. And that's the point, right? I shouldn't be doing that, right? You should be, right? You should be looking honest. I do my best to be honest. There's really a good explanation for all of this. Then the Gemara says, "Ein monan dan shtayim el achad achad." From this Gemara, if you just stopped right here, right here, what does the Gemara believe is your ultimate, right? What is one of your main responsibilities as a government official involved in government in public funds? To be trustworthy. Okay, if I stopped right here, and I asked you, okay, so what do you think? Would the Torah expect people to provide accounting of what they did, right? To provide accountability, right? Detail, this is how much money we collected, this is what we spent it on. What would you think? If you just stopped here, what would you think? Yes, right? If you had asked me, stop right here, the Gemara, right? If you said the Gemara is obsessive in how above suspicion you have to be, living in a modern context, I think we would all jump at it and say, aha, that means that the Gemara believes in accountability. Right? Does anyone not have that intuition after we read this Gemara? No? No one else has this intuition? Why not? Okay, Yehonatan's right. So why, Yehonatan, do you not have the intuition I had?
I mean,
you know, Hanami. But right, the Gemara means you need to be above suspicion, right? So you asked me what's one of the best ways of being above suspicion is, in the modern setting, it's open your books, right? It's make sure you have very detailed, very specific accounting of the money that came in and how it was spent, and make sure that the money that's in the bank account is exactly as much money as should fit those accounts, and that's how you will be transparent, right? That's the modern version of it, right? And therefore, and how do, when you have people who are hiding it, either they refuse to open their books or they cook the books. Right? You know that cook the books is a phrase. It means that they do have accounting. It's just wrong. It's lying. Right? Meaning they don't report all the money that comes in so that they don't have to. So according to the books, right, $1 million came in and $1 million went out. But that's not the truth. The truth is that $1 million came in by checks and bank transfers and another $300,000 in cash, and the $300,000 in cash didn't make it into the books, neither in nor out, and therefore the books look perfect, but they're not actually. Yeah, that's great. That's great. And again, we know in the modern context, right, the making it that you're not accountable by closing your... Think about... Again, I'm going to try to not be political, but let me take an example from politics. Okay? I'm not siding on it. But tell me, the fact that President Trump would not provide his tax returns, did that create suspicion? Simply the fact that he didn't want to be accountable, right? He did, right? Now, you might say he had good reason. If you like him, you'll see he had good reason. He doesn't have to show you his books, blah, 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 blah. That might be true, right? But the fact that people were asking him to be accountable, right, to be transparent, and he wasn't, created a chashad. So if I had frozen you on Chet Amud Bet and said, halacha goes way beyond what anything we know of in the modern world looks like in terms of demanding that you are above suspicion, I would have guessed that halacha would be all in on accountability, right? Transparency, right? I would have guessed it. That's my intuition, right? That's my intuition, right? I would be wrong, right? I would be wrong in halacha. Clearly, I would be wrong, right? Yes, Yonatan.
Well, it seems like the opposite is true. I mean,
okay, very good. So now, so look, et chata'ay ani maskir hayom. Yonatan, things like Chazal, I apparently didn't and had to be educated by Chazal, right? I thought, I read the sugya and said, right? I would have read the sugya and said, ah, Chazal want you to be above suspicion, so every mechanism at your disposal to put yourself above suspicion should be utilized, including transparency and accountability. But Yehonatan, things like Chazal, and Yehonatan said, good, you channel Chazal, very good. It's this is a good place for you to be in the machloket. It's me versus, right? Zeering against Chazal and Yehonatan. Okay, it's not a good, right? Or my Hava Amina. Fine. So good. You channel Chazal for me and tell me how do Chazal, at least the simple understanding of the Gemara as we have it in Bava Basra, how do Chazal think?
In that there's no like actual account of it, but rather just the appearance of
meaning what?
In that you only have to
well, okay, let's disavow what Rami said before, right? In order just to appear to be honest, you have to be honest and appear to be honest. Obviously, you have to be honest, right? That's a given, right? It's not just the appearance, right? That we don't like. People who appear to be honest and are not, we hate. We hate. Those are the worst. And that's not me speaking. That's Chazal, right? One of the groups of people that Chazal say are not Roeh Pnei Ashchina are the Mechanfim. Which the Gemara in Yoma, Pei Vav Amud Bet, makes clear, Mechanfin are those which are, want, right, make themselves look like tzaddikim, but they're not in private. Right? We hate those people. What? They're the worst. The worst. No, no. Hanifa is the worst. The worst, the worst, the worst. Fine. Okay, so let's try to get into Chazal's mind, right? Chazal seemed to have a different conception, right? Because what's the difference between the way Chazal deal with trustworthiness and the type of trustworthiness that comes from accountability? What's the difference? What? Well, if they really presumed honest, they sort of presume honesty, but they also are obsessive about you not looking dishonest in advance. So let's be clear. According to Chazal, right, if we're very careful, the type of being above suspicion that is outlined here in Ched Amud Bet is prophylactic. Right? It's prophylactic. What does prophylactic mean? What? It's not anaphylactic, it's prophylactic. For God's sake. What? Meaning, they believe that the best way to deal with trust is to make sure that you right? Okay, a vaccine is prophylactic.
So it's like preventative?
Yeah, it's preventative. Meaning, for Chazal, the best way to be above suspicion is not post facto be accountable, is to make sure that no one ever has any Hava Amina to suspect you. Right? But once they have no reason to suspect you, so then the Gemara says, Tedem and Aleph, Yonatan, what does the Gemara then say about accountability, which is post facto? Do you have to provide an accounting?
No.
Right? The Gemara says, the money collectors for tztaka and the people who are in charge of the treasurer of the funds in the Beit HaMikdash, you cannot force them to give an accounting. Even though there's no proof from the Torah, I can hint to it. Because the pasuk in Melachim Bet tells you, "V'lo yichashvu et ha'anashim, v'yidnu et ha'kezev al-yadam, l'deit lo'zei ha'malacha, ki ve'emuna heim osim." What's the reason?
Because they are trustworthy.
They are acting trust, right? With trust. Be'emunah heim osim. Okay, so what's the point? So why does the Gemara not want you to demand an accounting? Yeah.
Oh, because they're already trustworthy.
Right, because they're already trustworthy, and therefore asking for an accounting post facto is showing a lack of trust. Okay?
If you have a lack of trust, wouldn't you have
to get rid of the lack of trust? Ah. Okay. So here's the million-dollar question that I want to deal with, okay? Which is, the Gemara has a very different conception than the modern one of how you deal with trust. Right? The ideal, clearly, for Chazal is you should be trustworthy beyond trust, but you should do that in a prophylactic way. You should do it in a way that no one would ever trust you. But that creates a situation in which the community shouldn't demand accountability post facto, because what does that imply? That they don't trust you, and that's bad, right? You should trust the people who went out of their way to be so trustworthy. Okay.
Why?
So here, what?
Why do we have this assumption of trust?
So, Yaakov and Yonatan are asking the same question in different ways, right? Yonatan says, well, that's very nice, but why do we trust you so much? Yaakov says, what if we don't, right? Yeah. What if we don't trust you? So that's the question that I want to trace halachically. Today, right, and maybe tomorrow, what I want to do is I want to trace this the way I first learned it, but I find it very compelling, is that the sugya has a very specific idea of the way trust and accountability should work with each other, right? Which is, in the eyes of Chazal, fundamentally, being accountable, in the sense of actually providing an accounting, is not ideal, because it implies that there wasn't trust to begin with. But to compensate for that, or to prevent the need for accountability, right, for accounting, we go over and above in terms of creating a situation in which there's no reason not to trust you. The question then becomes, is that Chazal's only way of imagining the way trust and accountability work? But what happens if you don't trust people? And what happens if accountability, an accounting is what is necessary? How do you deal with the fact that Chazal clearly didn't think that was an ideal, because it's not ideal to be suspecting of your government and of your stucco collectors and the like? How do you deal with that, lemaisa, when the world changes? Okay, now, one second, Gavi, I'll take you in one second. Before we look at the other primary sources, I want to just look at one very suggestive Tosfos that for me is very important. Tosfos here says, well, why is the Pasuk from Melachim only a Zecher Ledavar and not a Raya Ledavar? Right, the Psukim in Melachim clearly say that they didn't ask for an accounting, Ki Be'emunahim Osim, because the assumption was that the people involved were honest. So why is that not good proof that you shouldn't ask people for an accounting? So Tosfos is a very short but very important comment. What does Tosfos say? Do you guys look? Tosfos said, Raya Gemura Eina. This isn't a proof. Deshaini Hatam Shayut Tzadikim Gemurim. Because there, the reason they needed accountability was because they were perfect Tzadikim. Right? He says, you can't prove from the case in Melachim that you can't demand an accounting, because the people we're talking about Melachim were tzaddikim. What's Tosfos getting at? The people in the time of Melachim didn't need an accountability because they were actually tzaddikim. The people in the time of the Gemara assumed were tzaddikim, but not at the level of the people in Melachim, and therefore, it's analogous to the time of Melachim, because they're also good people, so they might, you shouldn't have to demand an accounting because you should trust them. But it's not identical because they're not as tzaddikim. But that opens the question to Yaakov's cynical but obviously correct comment, which is, well, okay, in the time of the Navi, they were really tzaddikim. In the time of the Gemara, they were tzaddikim, but not as high a level. So, you know, they still didn't, it wasn't right to ask them for an accounting. But what happens if the people that are in charge are, you know, not quite at that level nowadays? What would Chazal say? Gavi, Ezra, Eli. Eli, also the question? Okay, well, I'll you ask it anyways if I didn't fully answer. But yes, Gavi. Very good. So that's why I said, in order to understand it, we need to track these two values through Chazal and then Poskim to see how would Chazal negotiate the modern scenario, right? Meaning Chazal clearly had an ideal, which is be above suspicion, and once people are above suspicion, don't do anything which would imply that you think that they are suspicious, right? That's Chazal, right? Be prophylactic and not retrospective in terms of accountability, right? Be prospective and not retrospective. Right? Make sure in advance that no one will suspect you, such that you don't have to be retrospective. Oh, okay, well, one second. Yes, Ezra.
Is that accurate that they were
men? Let's take Tosus at his word.
The
Pasuk says Be'emunahim Osim, so let's just take it at their word for now. But you're right. Right? Meaning there's a lot of problems here. But for this moment, Be'emunahim Osim. Okay? Fine. So, let's start with value one. The value that the Gemara on Chet Amud Bet was providing, which is the ideal in Chazal is to avoid suspicion prospectively. Prophylactically. Make sure that no one ever has reason to suspect you or doubt you. This is a mitzvah. This is a halachic value, and it comes to the fore in Shkalim. Okay? In Shkalim. So, let's go to Shkalim. What does the Mishnah tell you in Shkalim? Describe to me how obsessive we have to be of not doing anything that would make it look like you might, in any possible world in the multiverse, be dishonest. Right? None of you are philosophical enough to even care about the multiverse. This is like the bane of all modern philosophers. And comic books. But, you know, comic books are very into the multiverse. Also, right, it doesn't really matter which comics, right? They all have their own versions. But modern philosophers are very into the multiverse, you know. I literally had a professor who was the most analytic philosopher I've ever met in my life. Like, he worshipped analytic philosophy. Like, he used to live all the way out of the tip of Long Island. Like, all the way out, and then commute to YU, which you know what that's like, right? Like, you take the LIRR to the end, and then you take, right? And then you take the subway once you get into Manhattan, right? So it was like a two-hour each-way thing, and someone asked him, why? And he said, I like to spend the time ruminating, right? Pondering, right? Like, this is what he did. And he saw religious value in being he's a devout Christian, and then he eventually moved to take care of his mother in Riverdale. He walked in the snow on Christmas Day to teach philosophy in YU, right? Like, he was the most analytic, like, person I've ever met in my life. And he told me that he was convinced that he could prove God through an ontological, he has his own ontological argument, but the only flaw in it, and this is why he feels he can't fully prove God, because the ontological argument was, well, one was whether it depended on Gödel's theorem, but the other was it might not be true if there is a multiverse. It was like, okay, right? My analytic philosophers really are very into this multiverse thing. But anyways, the Mishnah in Shkalim tells you that the person in charge of the money to the Trumat HaLishka, what? Lo einatarem nichnas, lo bipargod chafut, velo v'min'al, velo bisandal, velo bitfilin, velo bikmeya. The person who's going in to deal with the funds of the Beit HaMikdash shouldn't go in with what? That's the Gemara. The Mishnah, shoes of any sort, cuffs in his pants, anywhere that he could hide money, he cannot go in, right? No pockets, no cuffs, no anything. And yes, the Yerushalmi, as understood by most of the Mepharshim, says he can't even go in if he has long hair, because he might hide money in his hair, right? Right? Yes, Yonah could not be the money, right? Hide it in that... and that afro, right? It just, you can't do it. He can't go in with tefillin. He can't go in with an amulet. He can't go with anything where you might hide anywhere, right? What? No, the Gemara clearly has amulets. We can talk about what they are, but there are different types of amulets. What? Well, some of them, no, but what type of amulets are talking, so, I mean, whatever. Some of them are ones with actual, like medicine in it. Right?
The wrong ones, they like the wrong.
Yes. But not, that's not the point. And listen to this amazing Mishnah. The Gemara says, why? Because we're worried that the following is going to happen. Okay? This is how afraid the Gemara is. This is how neurotic the Gemara is about being honest. I was talking about it with Andrew. So Andrew, tell me, what are we worried about? How obsessive are we? Now, what might happen? He might become rich, and then what will people say?
He stole.
Aha, we're worried. He'll become rich, and people will say, you see, he's stealing from the Beit HaMikdash. But you think that's bad. The Gemara says, what else might happen?
He might become poor,
and then what will we be worried about? People will say he's stolen, God is punishing him. Meaning, if his... bank account, literally, if his social standing goes up or down, people will assume that the reason that happened because he stole. Right? Shema, because if he becomes poor, people will say he's being punished for stealing from the Beit HaMikdash. Oh, Shema Yashir, Viyomru Chumar Alishka Yashir. And the Gemara says, isn't this obsessive? Right? I'm adding that in. But the Gemara says, isn't this a little bit obsessive? And what's the Gemara's answer? Or the Mishnah's answer, rather. 1 second. First, tell me, what's the Mishnah's answer? Why do you have to be so obsessive about being trustworthy? Because the Pasuk says, Sha'adam tzarich latzei yidei abriot, kiderech tzarich latzei yidei makom. Why do you read that language? You have to... right, you'd say you didn't want to be as right, fulfill your responsibilities with people as much as you do to God. Meaning, God knows you are honest. That doesn't matter. You are equally concerned about what people will say, no matter how crazy they are. Shneamar, because the pasuk says, "V'yitem nikiyim me'Hashem u'Yisrael." You have to be clean in the eyes of God and people. V'omer u'matzachen v'seichel tov, that you find grace. Beinei Elokim v'Adam, in the eyes of God and people. Okay? Yes, Ezra.
On the bed, it talks about if the Jared Ledger finds money in public, he finds on the street, it's whatever, you just keep it or whatever, right? Or something repays or paying or something, he should put it in. So it doesn't look like he's pocketing money to carry it. You should put it in and then go back and take it out at home. But doesn't the fact that he's able to go through the money by himself at home undermine any prophylactic things that you're doing? Like, you think, oh, okay, so he's not stealing it now. That's like,
apparently not.
Sneaking stuff in his sleeves.
I have the same practical problem as you. No, no, this is the Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash, you're not taking the money home.
Okay, fine.
Right? But you're right. Look, it's not a foolproof system. The Beit HaMikdash it might be, because you're dealing with it completely in the Beit HaMikdash.
Right.
But you're right, it's not foolproof. But my point is that the Gemara, when possible, wants you to go as far as you can. Right? As far as you can. And again, the Yerushalmi takes it further. Because it says what? Right? Don't go in if you have long hair. Right? Tanya Yishmael, Kavetz lo Yitrom ibn Echshad. The Rambam understands a little bit differently. But okay, let's assume like most Mefarshim. Don't go in with long hair, with an afro, because you might hide it in your hair. Right, and then the Gemara says they went farther. What would they do when the guy would go in?
They would go through his clothes.
And they would talk to him the whole time, right? Midabrini aya imo bishashu nichnas achashu yotzei. They would talk with him the whole time. Why? So he can't hide it in your mouth or you will hear it. And then the Gemara goes farther and it says, if you're going to be that obsessive, what does the Gemara suggest you do? Yes, before he goes in, make him fill his mouth with water. No, full.
Yeah, so you just swallow a tiny bit and then boom.
Right? Right? V'yamali v'mumei mai amar v'tanchu mipnei abracha. And the Gemara, I want you to realize how absurd this is. Listen, just listen to Ezra. Listen how extreme this Gemara is. The Gemara says, what's the Gemara's answer to why you don't make him go like this with his mouth? Because he has to say a bracha. So there's a technical problem. But what does that mean? That ideally, what does the Gemara want him to do?
Water.
Yes, if we could. Right? And if it were, right, you assume that, you know, you're almost surprised when you read this Gemara. The Gemara just doesn't say, well, why didn't he just go in naked? Right? Because this way he has nowhere to hide it. And the answer is because it's not Sanua. But if we could, we would. I mean, right? That is what the feeling you get. And the Gemara says, why? Let me just finish the Gemara. The Gemara says, Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman Shem, Rabbi Yonatan, Bitorah, Minivim, Duvim, Matzan, Shadam, Yep. Shadam, Tzarech, Let's say, Yedea, Brio, Kedech, Tzarech, Let's say, Yedea, Makom, Batorah, Minayin, Dechavitim, Nikim, Hashem, Yisrael. Minivim, Minayin, Dechavitim, Hashem, Vigom, Yisrael, Yedea, Biktuvim, Yisrael, Hu Yeda. Biktuvim, Minayin, Dechavitim, Matzachem, Vesechadov, Minay, Elokim, Vadam. And Gamliel Zugo Shalor Biosi Barbon Ezu Mechuvah Shebekulan Mamar Levitim Nekim Hashem Yisrael. So it quotes a pasuk from Torah for Nevim Uktuvim, which is our way of saying all of Torah focuses on this. The clearest is the one from Chumash, right? For reasons that maybe we can talk about, but whatever. But the Gemara is clearly very invested in this prophylactic. Don't make it that anyone distrusts you ever. Yes, Yonatan, and Ezra.
We say that the social action is only applicable to the Beit HaMikdash, but by, like, anything else, you wouldn't have this account.
But remember, our sugya was about staka.
Yeah.
And it also said to be prophylactic, don't require accounting. Right? Make sure that you always have two people, and they can always see each other. It's not as extreme as in the Beit HaMikdash,
yeah.
But it's the same idea. Don't have an accounting. Be obsessive in advance.
Well, let's say don't have accounting by that, or only by the Beit HaMikdash, they bring a proof of that to this.
No, because it's clear, you're right, we bring a proof of the Beit HaMikdash, but we say it applies to Tzaka too. Right? Now, yes, Ezra.
Two things. One, just in the process, isn't the two-person thing not based off of accountability?
No, it is. But the two people not being able to separate from each other is about accountability.
Well, no, if they're separated,
They always have to be with an eye shot.
Right, but that's because if they're separated, then you're having...
Okay, let's assume Rashi for now. Okay.
Well, but then if you're two brothers, and you're saying, then...
Good. If you wanted to, you could reread the whole Gemara. You're right. Like Rav Elchanan, you could reread this and say, that's not what's going on, is you need a chalos of two people.
Also,
okay, fair enough.
The whole mouth thing, I feel like it's more of their concern that he's going to swallow the coins than he's going to hide in his mouth, because they can look...
He's going to hide in his mouth, yeah.
Because they could just check it out. That's so much easier.
Okay.
The idea is that if you move the water thing...
Fine, swallow it. I have no idea if that was what they were worried about.
You wouldn't be able to swallow the coins without swallowing a significant amount of the water.
Okay, fine. Maybe they want him to. They don't want him to swallow the coin and remove it from his excrement. I don't know.
I think that's
most likely. Okay, fine. Yes, Adam. No, no, he has to make a bracha in there when he's doing the Truman Alishka. So he needs his mouth to be empty when he gets in. That's the problem. So I should have clarified. Right? Meaning he has bracha needs to make when he's in the Beit HaMikdash, and you're not allowed to make a bracha when you have water in your mouth. In general, by the way, this is true. Right? No, no, but even if a little bit of food, like if you have chewing gum in your mouth, you shouldn't be making a bracha either. You're supposed to make a bracha when your mouth is empty. That's the halacha.
What do you mean?
Empty. Like, empty. No food.
No spit.
Even things that you could put on the side and do it, we want you to praise God. The way that Chazal conceptualizes is you're supposed to praise God with your whole mouth. And when you're chewing, you're not using your whole mouth. I mean, you are, but not for the bracha. Okay. That's a sugya, Yehonatan. That's a sugya for another time. I don't want to get into it. Okay. Now, the Chazam Sofer looked at this at these Gemaras, and what did the Chazam Sofer say? Right? What was the Chazam Sofer's reaction to, reminder, we've met him before, but remind me who the Chazam Sofer is. His last name is Sofer, so I've given you half of it. What's his first name? No, actually not. He's father, or grandfather. Grandfather, I think. Moshe. His name is Moshe. Moshe Sofer, and he is the father of? Yonatan, remember? He's the father of what? More importantly than that, Haredi Judaism, right? He is the father of modern Haredi Judaism, right? He is the person who coined the phrase, or not coined the phrase, repurposed the phrase from the Mishnah that had to do with new grain to say that all innovation is asur of Chadash Asur Minat Torah. Right? He was the father of Hungarian Haredi Judaism, right? Yes, that's where it started, yes. I don't know. I have no idea. So he wrote in his Shuvot the following. Well, what did he say? This is my translation. Okay, so I'll read the translation, then I'll tell you why I translated in the first place. He says, "Know that my whole life I have been troubled by the verse, and you shall be clean before God and Israel." And these two obligations we have, to be clean before God and clean before Israel, his nation, these are two paired riders on our backs. However, it is much easier to fulfill the first obligation, meaning in the eyes of God, than it is the second, to fulfill one's obligation to people. For they, meaning people, think strange thoughts, and the weavers speak of it by moonlight. This is, by the way, the Gemara's image, right? All gossip for the Gemara happened by weavers at night, right? They would be outside in the moonlight weaving and sewing and gossiping. This is like Chazal's image, okay? Its punishment is quite severe, to no end, more than one who does not fulfill his obligation to heaven, God forbid. This emerges from the Talmud at the end of chapter Yom Kippurim, the eighth chapter of Yoma, regarding desecrating God's name, which has no atonement, such as when a rabbi purchases meat but does not pay right away. Right? The Gemara says, Chilul Hashem is the worst of the worst. In our great iniquity, people commonly talk about how this studious person did such and such. It is fluent in their mouths, even if it is just a suspicion. And in this case, even if the studious person acted properly in the eyes of God as much as possible, but not carefully enough, such that some drunkards made a mistake about him and wrote mocking songs about him, he has been caught in their trap. Over this, all sufferers shall grieve. And the verse screams out, "You have let them ride over us." And I have wondered many times if it is even possible that a person in the history of the world has fully fulfilled this verse. Perhaps this idea is included in what King Shlomo said, "There is no righteous person in the world who does only good and no wrong." Which means to say that even if his deeds were all good in the eyes of God, it is impossible to not sin in the second way, fulfilling the obligations in the eyes of people. So what does the Chazam Sofer say?
It's impossible.
It is impossible! What is the standard that the Torah expects of us? So I used this Chazam Sofer when I wrote, so as I said, a few years ago I was writing a weekly halacha article on halacha in the age of social media, which is really halacha in the digital age in general. And I basically said, if this was true a few hundred years ago, the implications for how careful you must be in the world of social media is, you know, as we say in halachic language, kal vachomer ben binoshel kal vachomer, right? Which is a very rabbinic phrase, right? That it literally means an a fortiori argument, the grandson of an a fortiori argument, right? That's literally what it means. Kal vachomer ben bino, right? The kal vachomer is the grandfather of a kal vachomer, grandson of the kal vachomer, but means the way I started it was the following story. Okay, I have published it with permission, so I can say it. When I was in Toronto, NCSY Toronto went on a Shabbaton to New York, and they were on to the Upper West Side. Motzoi Shabbos, after whatever Havdalah, Kumsitz, whatever, they were walking home, but they had finished Shabbos, but they hadn't yet gotten home, so they still didn't have their phones and their wallets and whatever. They were walking through Central Park, and they ran into Conan O'Brien. And they asked Conan O'Brien if they could take a picture. So he took a selfie with NCSY Toronto and posted it to his Instagram and said that I took this picture because these students didn't have their phones because of the Sabbath. Okay? Yes, we're good so far with this story. Rabbi Gil's student on his website Torah Musings finds out about this and writes an article about the problems of taking selfies, celebrity selfies on Shabbos. That article gets back to Toronto, and the principal of the school gets angry. Right? Because now his students have been accused of violating Shabbos just to take a celebrity selfie. Right? The rabbi who had escorted the students to this Shabbaton correct the story and say, no, that's not what happened. It was already deep into Motzei Shabbos. We just hadn't been home. And what Conan O'Brien had meant was because it had been the Sabbath, we didn't have our phones with us. Right? Followed up with Rabbi Gil's students, who then issued an apology and a correction post, but then wrote an article about whether he said he was wrong, b'mitzius, in suspecting them, but halachically, was he actually within his rights to have suspected them, because from his vantage point, it looked so bad. Did he have an obligation to judge them favorably, which then led to a sicha back in Toronto by the principal of the school, Roy Grauer, who said, look, if you have learned anything from this story, it's that you kids should be really careful, because one misstep, right, and forever this is preserved online, even if it was a mistake. Okay, you got that very convoluted story, right? Oh, yeah. But, well, yes. So, when I wrote my, when I was writing this series, I reached out both to Rai Grauer and to Rai Gil's student, right? They were both aware that I was, you know, involved in this. But I use this as an example of how these halachot have been affected by social media, because the Chassam Sofer 200 years ago was saying, it's impossible. There's nothing you can do, right, to make sure that people don't suspect you. Right? And I said, aha, look at what this looks like here, right? Innocently, these students are walking through Central Park in an NCSY Shabbaton, right? And Conan O'Brien posts a misphrased, you know, description on the picture on his Instagram page, and the next thing you know, there's an article written against them on a prominent Jewish website that they are violating Shabbos with celebrity selfies, right? Which leads to a whole apology, right? But look how careful, right? If the Chassam Sofer said in his time it was impossible to be above suspicion, right? Social media has made it, you know. In a Hanami. But, fine. In a Hanami. In Echanami. Look, I know everybody in this story, right? Because I was in Toronto at the time, so I know... What? Okay, I know almost everybody in this story. You're right. You're right. I knew the kids. I knew the Rebbe. I knew Ray Grauer. I knew Ray student. At least we've corresponded. I don't think I've ever met him, but we've corresponded, and I've written for him before on his website, right? You know, I will just say at this point, I really do try very hard to be, if I write a piece which is critical of somebody, right, even halakhically, I do try to show it to them before I publish it. So, right, Gil student was very, very gracious that I didn't agree with his halakhic assessment, but I sent it to him, my assessment in advance, and we had a productive conversation about the sugya. So, like, you know, I do think, like, in general, if you're going to write something against someone and disagree with them, even if, like, even if, like, you should tell them, like, that is courteous. I do try to go as, you know, as much as I can to do this. But this is side one of the equation, right? Like, the Gemara's idea of how obsessive you must be to make sure that no one suspects you is... Right? I mean, Hanukkah is coming up, and maybe this is the Hanukkah sugya we should do, right? Because this is maybe one that you haven't done as much, right? If you want to do a Hanukkah sugya, and I can justify it as the expansion of this sugya, right? But there's a very important Hanukkah sugya that's based on this. Hanukkah halacha, which is?
That meal starts 12.
Yeah. He's what?
Starts at 12.
Yeah, I know, but it's only 10-2. I still have time. I still have time.
Yeah,
okay, fine. I'll stop in 5 minutes then. Right? Is, right, if you have a big house, right, with a yard and with multiple entrances, what's the halacha? How many menorahs do you have to light? What? Wrong. One at an entrance on every direction. Lest someone pass your house and say, aha, that person didn't light a menorah because I saw his door, there was no menorah there. Even though the person could round the corner and say, well, there's another entrance, he lit it there. No! B'nei achshad, you are obligated to light a menorah at every entrance to your gate, to your gated yard. Nowadays, we don't do it because we assume that once it's in the windows and it's not really for the people on the outside, so they'll assume it's on the other side. But in the time of the Gemara, you had to do it on every side. And by the way, Ad Hayom, right? I actually do this, L'chumra. Right? I light my menorah at my door outside, right? But I have one of the other menorahs in my house, my wife's menorah, my kid's menorah, something in the window, right? Because there isn't room for all of them at the front door. So I light one at the front window, I'm like, I don't think I'm actually chayev to, but, you know, the sugya already said I might be chayev to, so, l'ravcha demilt, as they say, I have a menorah in the window on one side of the house, a menorah at my door on the other side of the house. Yes?
If it's one person, I get all of them,
but you have to make a bracha on each one. No, you don't make a bracha on the chshad ones. Okay. Now, chshad is a little different than marat ayin. So maybe, I tried to not get into that too much. It's a fascinating joke, but I tried not to get into it here. But this is basically one side of this equation, which is that Chazal are obsessive about prophylactically making sure that no one will ever doubt you, suspect you about anything under any circumstances. To a point that Chazal so far could in all integrity say that is not possible. The standard is inhuman. And yet, despite that, or maybe because of that, or maybe both because of it and despite it, right? The Gemara says that once you do that, you don't have to provide a post facto accounting, because that means that someone doesn't suspect you, and that's a problem. Right? And that's what the Gemara on Daf Tetam and Aleph tells you. Now, the case where... Okay, you know what? Let's stop there. Tomorrow what we'll do is balance it and say, okay, but now let's analyze this presumption of honesty and the expectations or lack thereof of accountability. Right? The Gemara clearly didn't expect an accounting, but what do we do nowadays where the reality is that people are not that trustworthy or are just have been scarred so much by dishonest politicians and leaders and whatever that they're cynical. Yaakov's like, I'm not responsible for being that cynical, right? It's the system. People are really that bad, right? Yes, we know. Leaders are terrible, right? If you ever want to read an excellent, unbelievable book, which is both the most cynical and real, like, hard-nosed perspective on politics that I've ever read, it's a book called The Dictator's Handbook by two professors at the Hoover Institute, which is like the popularized version. It is incredible. It is like the most cynical thing ever. It's basically the whole assumption is that, yes, besides for like five politicians in the history of the universe, everyone is just in it for self-interest. And right, the basic thesis of the book is that everyone's in it for self-interest. The only reason that democracy is better than any other system usually is because in order to stay in power, they have to please more people. And therefore, it's in their self-interest to be better, as opposed to in dictatorships with natural resources, they don't need to be nice to anybody in order to serve their self-interest. So democracies are only better because they are taking a very honest look at the fact that everybody is bad and only cares about themselves, but incorporates that into the political system. Right? That's basically, in a nutshell, the thesis of the book. I have incorporated it into Shirim, right? You know, it does an analysis of why, like, North Korea is the most educated country on the face of the planet when it comes to literacy, right? But, like, the lowest in terms of higher education. What? They have, like, no. And they point, no, it's fascinating, right? He has a whole analysis because you need to read because you must follow the rules and be able to read propaganda. But they don't want you to think. And therefore they have the, like, it's like 99% literacy rate, but like almost 0% with college degrees. Because they want everybody to be able to read without analyzing, right? It's like this fascinating. It's an amazing book. I have used it to explain, like, several of the Mefarshim comments on how the Jews could have plausibly said they ate well when they were slaves in Egypt, right? So several of the Mefarshim, if you see this passage about North Korea, it, like, anyways, Brian Mann is starting, so I'm going to have to stop. Tomorrow we'll finish this sugya. It's a really good book. If you want to read, like, a really, really good book, you should get your hands on it. It is, like, the most cynical, honest book I have ever read about politics. It is unbelievably good. So good. Yes?
There's a YouTube.